one of the Ten Commandments is you shall have no other gods before me. Now, some of the passages will say beside me. Almost literally, it says by my face, in my presence, is the idea. But I want to start off with sort of a theoretical framework in our discussion to sort of lay the groundwork for what we're going to be doing a little bit later. And one, I want to ask the question, what is the appeal, or why is there an appeal of polytheism? And we live in a world that still has effects of this. There are nations where people are very polytheistic. Some would argue that even in the United States, we still are, and I, within parameters, would agree with that, at least on a metaphorical kind of level. But the anthropological approach to the idea of polytheism sort of has a family tree that looks sort of like this. I realize this is backwards, but this is sort of the way the anthropologists and sociologists will look at the idea of development of religion. Now, this is to a large extent from a secularistic point of view, and the belief that in the beginning there are multiple deities, and eventually things evolved to where there was a belief, at least in some cultures, of a single deity. And this is the perspective that most of your sociological discussions of religion will do. And hence, you'll often hear the declaration that Akhenaten was the first monotheist. And of course, that is contingent upon when one dates Moses in the Exodus. Moses would either be dated immediately before Akhenaten or immediately after. But Akhenaten we can date with some more certainty because of the chronology system of Egypt and so forth. But it's debatable even though whether Akhenaten himself was a monotheist. But this is the perspective that tends to characterize most perspectives, most interpretations. Now to a large extent, this perspective and the belief in polytheism, regardless of when polytheism comes into play, is an issue that relies upon one's self-interpretation. Paul argues in Romans chapter 1 about the tendency for people to turn things into gods, fashioning them in their own image and so forth. And then the principle, in a sense, there's a way, and I realize probably the proverbialist is talking about something else, but there's a way that seems right to a person, but then there are other ways of death. And both of these premises have to do with looking at the world around us and trying to understand the world as we perceive it. The problem that we have with this family tree kind of evolutionary look is that the records that we have recorded in documents in Mesopotamia and Egypt all tend to start off with a very polytheistic perspective. Now, we have not discovered any, to my knowledge at least, any documents that present a monotheistic thing significantly earlier. So as far as the documentation is concerned, the first introduction that we have of religion and perceptions of God are all from a polytheistic perspective. But I want to consider also the logic, if you will. I'll put that in quotes. And I want to propose to you that the issue in part is a perspective, and coming back to the relying upon oneself and one's understanding. Not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago, Brother Hook presented a chapel speech, and some of you that were in there will remember that, and he talked about having something in his pocket that he's never seen before. He posed a series of questions. You know, I'm going to tell you something absolutely true. Do you have any faith in me? And, you know, the audience all said, yes, we believe that you're going to tell us the truth. And then he began affirming that he had something in his pocket that he's never seen before and that no one's ever seen before. And then asked, now do you still believe me? And the number of hands continued to drop and so forth as he continued. And then he eventually pulled out a peanut and gave it to me to testify, you know, what is this? And then he opened the peanut up, and of course nobody had ever seen the peanut. And then you sort of felt like an idiot for not trusting him. Now his point ultimately was that, do we trust the testimony of the individual? And the question that we pose here is, do we trust the testimony of God? But in reality, we have a tendency to interpret things almost incessantly on our own perceptions, our own understanding of what's going on in the world around us. And I want to propose this is sort of what the problem is with the logic of polytheism. Because the questions that are posed as we look at in nature are the apparent contradictions that exist. You have fire and water, and these are almost polar opposites in the ancient world and even to an extent within our world. You know, we'll put out a fire with water, and we know that that fire can also evaporate water more quickly than just leaving it alone and so forth. So this sort of this contradiction. Now, the ancients were great observers of what was going on. I'm not going to argue they were very good at always explaining the why. But because of their ability to observe the contradictions in the world, they wanted to try to come up with some understanding and explanations of the why. And this is sort of what science is all about, is the attempt to explain why is it that we see what we see. Another contradiction has to do with the contrast between winter and summer. Now, as we watch the world and we understand it from our perspective in our world today, we understand that there is a universe and that the winter-summer has to do with the rotation of the Earth on its axis and then the tilt of the Earth in relationship to the perpendicularity of the sun. So that when the Earth is like this and the sun is over here, it's summer in the southern hemisphere, and then when the Earth rotates in this other direction on its axis, then summer in the northern hemisphere. Now, we understand the mechanics of this, but apparently the people in the ancient world did not, and so it was much easier in their understanding to think in terms of there's somebody in charge of these respective components, and that there would be this conflict between the somebodies, gods, and at certain points in time, there's a certain god would be superior over the other god, but then there would be a resurrection of a deity or a revitalization of a deity that has gone dormant for a while, and then you'll have the dominant winter or summer depending on what's going on. Now, this is a terrible oversimplification, but I think you can begin to see sort of the dynamic that is involved here. A universe, a one concept truth that we have here, is not something that most of them were able to get their heads around. And still, we often will wrestle with elements of this. How do you explain, how would they explain the difference between daylight and darkness? By the way, this is a picture of sunrise over the Dead Sea and a moon view over the Sea of Galilee. It's always great to go over there and get nice pictures like this. Dr. Culbertson has been with me on these trips. And matter of fact, we probably were in the same room together when I took the Galilee one. But these apparent contradictions, how do we explain them? And again, we come back to an understanding of the rotation of the Earth. And of course, there was the big dispute in the Middle Ages of Galileo, who's arguing for a solar-centric kind of solar system rather than the sun rotating around the Earth. And of course, he gets in all kinds of trouble because of his affirmations, although we do know that other people earlier had a better understanding than was prevalent at the time of Galileo. But the explanation in the ancient world, in some cases, is bizarre, and I'm going to come and eventually show you one of the explanations, at least from Egypt. Another one of those apparent contradictions in nature has to do with the perception that there are gods in charge of certain areas. As we've looked at these other, there's a god of fire, there's a god of water, there's a god of the day and the god of the night, and here you would have a god of the hills. Now, this actually comes into the biblical narrative. In 1 Kings, you have a conflict that arises between Ahab and Ben-Hadad. And in the battle that has ensued, Ahab has been victorious over Ben-Hadad. And they're trying to figure out, why in the world did we lose with all of our military to Ahab? And so his advisors point out to him that, well, it's because their God, the Israelites' God, is a God of the hills. And so let's have the battle out in the valley, in the plain, because their God is a God of the hills, but he's not a God of the plain. And so if we can suck them out into the plain and the valley, then we will be victorious. Now, what I find interesting here is God is really ticked at Ben-Hadad for thinking this. And so God makes the affirmation, I'm going to show Ben-Hadad, I'm going to let Ahab win. Now, this really implies some significant theological element, because Ahab, of all people, that God is going to give the victory in order to make a point with Ben-Hadad. I mean, this is a big deal. Now, this is a picture of the Sumerian hills. Running chariotry around in this is not very easy. And, of course, Assyrians would have some chariotry. Ahab had some, but chariotry doesn't work well in the hill areas. But apparently Ahab had a facility of fighting in the hills, because this is sort of the domain in which he lives. And so there would be military prowess that he would have at his disposal with the Israelites. Here's an area of Jezreel Valley. The Mount Gilboa is over here on the right side. That's the hill of Moreh. And obviously, to engage in a battle out here would be much more suitable for territory and open territory and so forth. Now, the battle that we're describing here did not take place in the Jezreel. But nonetheless, this perception of a god of the hills and a god of the plain is this contradiction in nature, or this perception of territoriality of the deities, and hence sort of a logic kind of problem that comes into the discussion. The biblical perspective of theism is that you start off with there's one God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so God stakes a claim to worship him and him alone. But my mother used to talk about me being occasionally too smart for my britches. Any of you heard that phrase? All right. Some of the older ones have heard that. Fortunately, mother can't say that anymore, although I do miss my mother. But she doesn't utter those kind of things anymore. Anyway, we'll leave that alone. But as people begin to try to think through why, for a lot of folks, it's easier to begin thinking, well, there's another God, and there's another God, and there's another God. And then, well, wait a minute, they have sub-gods and so forth. On a certain level, what God is doing in the pages of the Bible is the affirmation, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And these other gods, by the self-reliance of human insight and wisdom, begins to develop these perspectives that there must be other gods, because this is the only way reasonably in our thinking to explain the apparent contradictions that are going on. And then God is going to come back, and he's going to say, let's reverse the system, and I want you to believe in only me. And we're still struggling in humanity over in this area, as we try to come back to the perspective of one God. Now, in Exodus chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, Moses has been summoned by the Lord to be the one to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. And he goes into Pharaoh and he says, thus says the Lord, I'm going to rephrase this to accentuate his name, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel. Now, there's an implied almost territorial, at least a conceptual territoriality there, because the Egyptians don't worship Yahweh at all. Thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may celebrate a festival to me in the wilderness. And Pharaoh looks at him and he says, who is the Lord? Who is Yahweh that I should obey him? I don't know Yahweh, neither will I let Israel go. Now, we have a tendency to read this and think how defiant he is. And on a certain level, he is being defiant. I'm not going to deny that. But there's a logic that is involved here, a logic from his perspective. What right does this God, that not necessarily that he's never heard of, but what right does this God have to come in and demand of me, Pharaoh, who represents Ra? What right does this God of this other people have a right to come in and demand of me to liberate these people, at least for even briefly, for a festival? I don't recognize him. Now, there's a lot of discussion that tends to go in Bible classes about what does it mean I don't know Yahweh? Does that mean, I never heard this name before? This is my first introduction to the name Yahweh? I'm more inclined to think it's sort of like I don't recognize his right to make this claim. It's sort of like the United States with Cuba. You know, for a long time, we didn't recognize Cuba. We knew full well Cuba was there. But politically, we didn't recognize them. What right does Cuba have to say anything to us? Because, and you know, eventually, then there's a political shift that takes place. I don't think Pharaoh is necessarily oblivious to who Yahweh is. Now, that's my opinion. I can't prove it. But what he's getting at, I think, is more characteristic of what right does your God have to make a demand of me, since obviously, in his mind, your God, Yahweh, must be a wimp. Otherwise, why do you explain Israel being in slavery? Clearly, the Egyptian gods are superior to your God, and so you have no right. I don't recognize the legitimacy. Now, you have to remember, Pharaoh represents and thinks of himself as the representation of Ra, the sun god. Now, here is a portrayal from Medina Habu where the king is beating on the enemy. And this is sort of the mindset that Pharaoh would have had about the Israelites. What right does your God to have in view of the fact that I'm the one who's the king? So who's in slavery? Not the Egyptians. And the perception is that the Egyptian gods must be superior. Now my proposition here is that on a certain level, what Pharaoh says makes sense to him. After 10 plagues, there's a different ballgame. And that's actually part of the point of the 10 plagues. As we look at this mindset of territoriality, we see examples of this in the pages of Scripture. The picture of the Ark of the Covenant, this is from the ESV Study Bible. The picture of the Ark of the Covenant here, you have an episode in the history of the children of Israel, 1 Samuel chapter 4, where the Israelites are fighting against the Philistines. Most people are familiar with the story. And they've lost round one. And so they get the bright idea, let's bring the territoriality of our God into the battle. So let's get the Ark of the Covenant, as if there's sort of a radius within which God will not allow anyone to encroach, and we will therefore be victorious. Well, God is irritated with this. And he allows the Philistines to capture the Ark, which is an ultimate insult to the Israelites. But the Philistines are going to have their own set of problems that ensue as a result of this. But the point here is this territorial mindset that characterizes the Israelites. So they're thinking not in terms of a universal God. There's a sense in which they're thinking in terms of a God who has sort of a radius exuding influence and power, perhaps beyond which then there is less power. That's the reason we lost the first battle. So let's get the Ark in the battle with us. Then, of course, there's the other episode that I referred to a moment ago with Ben-Hadad and Ahab and the battle. Let's get them out into the hill, into the valleys and the plains so we can fight against them because their God is the God of the hills. Well, again, this is the way Pharaoh is looking at the Israelites. Now, the Israelites had, to a large extent, themselves lost touch with Yahweh. I'll come back to an element of this in a moment, but consider the pagan context of the patriarchs. Now, I do believe that Abraham worships Yahweh. I'll come back to that a little bit later. But it's fairly clear that at least his family is not all devoted to Yahweh. Because you have references to children of Israel needing to get rid of the teraphim. Jacob is going to gather up the teraphim among his family and bury them under the terebinth at Shechem, there at the sanctuary. And this is significantly later. Then you also have, apparently, Moses' anticipation when he's talking to the Lord at the burning bush, giving his objections as to why I ought not be the one to go lead the children of Israel out of slavery. And one of those objections, well, what if they ask what your name is? What do I say? Now, on a certain level, this could be understood that they're oblivious to who Yahweh is, which is a possibility. On another level, the Israelites have lost their confidence in Yahweh. Again, because they are in slavery. And they're looking at this from the standpoint of victory and supremacy, and they're suffering with all of this. Another evidence of Israel having lost touch with Yahweh is the quickness to which they resort to building a golden calf. It's within 3 months they're building a golden calf. These are your gods, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Now I can only imagine how incensed Yahweh is at this. Obviously, he is angry about it. But perhaps the most explicit issue is Joshua's remarks as he delivers that discussion there in Joshua chapter 24. If it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, then choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods our fathers worshiped beyond the river or in Egypt. So apparently the Israelites were at least worshiping and recognizing some of the gods of Egypt and devoted to them. And some have argued that the golden calf there that they make is an Apis bull, which would be out of the extract of the Egyptian world rather than the bull of Baal and so forth. But that's open to question. Nobody knows for sure. But there are a number of points here that give an indication that Israel has lost touch with Yahweh. They come out of a heritage of polytheism. They come out of a context of slavery. They come out of a context where they would view their God as at least inferior to the gods of the victors, the Egyptians. And so where is this God who brought us up and this Moses who led us out? Let's build a golden calf. These are your gods, O Israel that brought you up out of the land of Egypt, rather than Yahweh. The exasperation that Moses feels, the exasperation that Yahweh must feel in all of this. There's a sense in which Yahweh needs to prove himself. It's interesting as you go through the pages of Scripture, God does not make a faith claim on us without evidence. He doesn't just sort of pop out of the scene and say, believe in me. He demonstrates who he is, what he is, the power that he exhibits before he comes along and says, now will you follow me and serve me? This is the classic sequence of fact, testimony, and faith. Okay? The fact is what God has done. So God, in a sense, needs to prove himself. And when I say needs, this is not compelling to the character of God, but God recognizes the foibleness and feebleness of humanity. One of the areas, he's going to prove himself over the gods of Egypt. This is explicit in Exodus chapter 12, verse 12. Now, what's interesting is that this declaration is made at the end of the sequence of the plagues, as he's coming into the 10th plague. But he's going to render judgment on all the gods of Egypt. Well, again, the perception of the Israelites and the Egyptians both would have been the gods of Egypt must be superior because we've been in slavery. But over and over and over and again, God has demonstrated that he is superior to any of the entities that characterize Egypt. Now, the Egyptologists will typically come along, and I'm not going to dispute with them here because they certainly are more adept at that data bank than I. But the Egyptologists will come along and say, we have difficulty identifying a specific deity that to associate with each of the respective plagues. Okay, so how are we to look at this? Now, admittedly, some of them we can connect. Turning the water to blood is a slap to the Nile god. The night of darkness is a slap to the sun god Ra. There's also an Osiris insult that takes place with the death of the firstborn, and a number of those we can identify. But regardless, the Egyptians would have viewed that somehow the divine world is in charge of essentially everything that goes on. I would describe that the Egyptians had here a god, there a god, everywhere a god. And so whatever the convenience is that they need in order to facilitate their success, there would be a god associated with that in some fashion. Some of them are national, some of them are regional, some of them are domestic and personal. This is the way human beings tend to be. So God is going to decree that he has rendered judgment on all the gods of Egypt. Well, he also needs to demonstrate to Pharaoh. Several times, four times in the sequence of the discussion, there is an affirmation that Moses makes to Pharaoh, and you shall know that Yahweh is God. He's a little slow in the uptake. Now, I envision Pharaoh to be sort of that bully kind of kid that, you know, all of us have encountered at some point. Please don't be one of them. But that bully kind of kid that all of us have encountered that he knows better than to do what he does, but he's so stubborn and obstinate in his behavior that he just sort of digs into that stubbornness even more tightly. That's Pharaoh. And finally, when he does allow the children of Israel to go, it's only a little small window when he finally comes to the realization, what have we done? And then God is going to demonstrate his victory over him again in the death of the and destruction of the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. He's also going to be demonstrating his supremacy over the gods of Egypt to the Egyptians. Three times in the narrative, the text talks about the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh, a God. Now, the Egyptians have caught on much more quickly than Pharaoh did. It's with the third plague that the advisors, the magicians, finally say, this is out of our league. This is the finger of God at work here. You know, we can't even replicate this. Of course, looking at the replication of the first two plagues, you know, you got a plague, so you make more plague. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. But that's what the magicians did, rather than neutralize what Moses has done, what God has done. But the declaration to the Egyptians is profound. And eventually you're going to have the advisors of Pharaoh coming along and saying, don't you realize that our country is ruined because of this? Let Israel go. Listen to what this man has to say. And Pharaoh is resolute in his refusal to allow the Israelites to leave. But the Egyptians are beginning to come around. So that when finally the Israelites do leave, and the Israelites ask for gold and silver and plunder, the Egyptians are more than happy to unload extreme volumes of gold and silver and clothing and so forth, that probably in part becomes part of the contribution that they make to the construction of the tabernacle. But I find it interesting that there is this discussion that you also need to demonstrate to the Israelites. In Exodus chapter 10, verses 1 and 2, and you have to look at this carefully, because otherwise it's easy to miss. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I have dealt harshly with the Egyptians, and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am Yahweh." That you may know. This is the eighth plague. So apparently there's still a reluctance on the part of the Israelites to subscribe to who Yahweh is. And God is working with them in this. Now finally, when they are going to leave after the tenth plague, you have the declarations in chapter 12 and 13 about the Passover, when the children will ask in the celebration of the Passover, "What does this mean?" Or in the modern rendition, "What makes this day different than all others?" Then the story is told and repeated about how our forefathers were in slavery and God by a mighty hand has led us out from slavery into a land of promise. But Israel needed to get on board. But then also to Israel's eventual neighbors. In chapter 15, in the Song of the Sea, you have this declaration where the song says, "The people have heard, they tremble, pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed, trembling seizes the leaders of Moab, and all the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away." Now, all of this is stated as if it has already occurred, but clearly in the chronology of this, they are not going to encounter Philistia and Moab and Edom and the Canaanites yet for a while, some 40 years. But it's spoken as if the reality is going to occur, or at least in a sense has already occurred. I doubt it was immediate telegraph to the people. But we do have a situation in Philistia where when the Ark of the Covenant, dealing with them in the order in which they are listed here, when the Ark of the Covenant is taken into battle, the Philistines respond, "Oh no!" They hear the clamor and the rejoicing in the camp of the Israelites and they wonder what has happened. Gods have come, and these are the gods that allowed Israel to cross to the Red Sea. They hark back to this event. While I don't know of a specific episode with Edom, certainly it's implicit with Moab when Balak sends to Balaam and he's concerned about these people that have come out of the land of Egypt. And of course, Rahab is going to make the declaration, "We know what has happened." I can only imagine the Israelites, the Canaanites at this point, the flight from the land of Egypt, the crossing of the Red Sea, the rumblings and the reports of the plagues that occurred down in the land of Egypt. And yet then this group of folks get lost, I put that in quotes, lost out in the wilderness. And so they sort of fade from memory until finally the Israelites systematically are taking care of the 2.5 the area where the tribe, 2.5 tribes are going to settle, Sihon and Og. And then the question is, who are these people that are wiping up and licking up the people on the other side of the Jordan? Oh, these are the people that God delivered, that Yahweh delivered back 40 years ago. And so there's this resurrection of the memory of this. And Rahab specifically brings it up when she's talking to the spies, the Canaanites. The Gibeonites do exactly the same thing. Their argument when they have engaged in this ruse, that they have clothes that are worn out, wineskins that have been patched, sandals that have worn out, and bread that is crusty and moldy and all this. This is all fresh, and these were all new when we left home. We've traveled a long distance. When you get to our borders, and the Israelites ask, "Well, why have you done this?" "Because we've heard of what your God is and what he did." The Canaanites had heard. The testimony, or the fact, the testimony, and the faith. The sequence is there. The irony in this is it seems like in some senses the Israelites were the slowest ones to get it. in spite of being the chosen people. Why does God address the issue as if the other gods are real? This is a bit of a mystery. Polytheism, I define, this is the quick and dirty definition, this works easily. It's not your formal anthropological definition. The polytheism is the belief that multiple gods exist and that one worships multiple deities. Not necessarily worships all the deities, but you worship multiple deities. It's probably a pick and choose kind of thing. The ones that you like or the ones that you perceive to be most advantageous and so forth. Monotheism is defined here as the belief that there is only one God and that one worships him or her, depending on how one perceives monotheism. Biblical monotheism is typically described as him. And then there's another term that comes into it. Polytheism means many god, many gods, not M-I-N-I, but M-A-N-Y, all right? Monotheism means one god, and henotheism means one god. But there's a difference in concept between monotheism and henotheism. Henotheism is defined as there may be or may not be more than one god, but the devotee only worships one. May leave the question unaddressed. The person who is a henotheist may believe that there are multiple deities, but he or she has chosen to worship one. The person may not know whether there are other gods or not, but the person certainly is worshiping one. The monotheist is convinced there is only one God. All right? May I propose to you that there's a sense in which, if one is a henotheist, for all practical purposes, you're a monotheist. For all practical purposes. Because you're going to tailor your behavior, your thinking, along the line of worshiping only one deity. Now, my proposal here harks back, and this became impressed upon me when, years ago, when we still lived in San Diego, I preached in San Diego for several years, and one of our children was born just before we moved to San Diego. And Cindy was in the first grade, and she's the oldest, and all these fundraising things that go on in elementary school. Okay, so the fundraising flyer comes around and everything else, and so, what are we going to do? We got to get something. And at the time, we were concerned about our three-year-old son, who, nothing wrong with him, but he's 3 years old, okay? They're not right on top of stuff, okay? So we were concerned about maybe him getting lost, and Walmart was not out there then, so I'm going to use Kmart. That was our domain of shopping. Didn't have much money. So we had this vision of being in Kmart and perhaps him getting separated from us. And, somebody says, little boy, what's your name? Elijah. What's your mommy's name? Mommy. What's your daddy's name? Daddy. Where do you live? At home. I mean, three-year-olds don't tend really to be right on top of how to answer some of these questions in a meaningful kind of way. I don't remember whether Elijah would have known at 3 years old what my name is or what Sharon's name is, okay? Much less where he lived. He could probably identify it if he were to see it, but you're not going to drive all over Santee, California looking for that apartment. So we decided, it would be handy, this little flyer, this fundraising flyer has this little bracelet in it. And so the little bracelet, we thought we'd get a little bracelet, and on the back of it, it has his name and address and phone number. And things were a little bit different, by the way, back then than they are now. And so we were looking forward to this little bracelet coming in. Now, in the meantime, Elijah, being about 3 years old, we lived in a two-story house. And we put him to bed about 8 o'clock. And about 11, he would come sort of tumbling down the steps in his little footsie pajamas, little fuzzy things, just bawling his little eyes out. And you could tell it was one of those, you could tell the difference in the cries of your children. Some of them are defiant cries, but this was a terrified, heartbroken cry. He was petrified about something. And he was just crying out his little heart. And we finally get him calmed down enough, and just, Elijah, what's wrong? A skunk's going to get me. Huh? a skunk? Where'd this come from? No, Elijah, the skunk's not going to get you. You know, mommy and daddy are here, and we'll take care of, you know, if a skunk comes around, we'll take care of it. Please don't. We even made the remark that skunks are more afraid of you than you are of it. I'm not sure that's true, but it works, you know. Everything that we did, we'd finally calm him down, and we'd take him back up to bed, and he'd calm down, and, you know, about 11. This is sort of my working hypothesis as I'm trying to sort through what is going on in the pages of Scripture. So my proposal is, why does God address it as if there are other gods? Because they are convinced that there are other gods. And this competing worldview and the contradictions of nature and all of that may well be under the guidance and auspices of certain deities. But Yahweh is superior over all of them. And Yahweh is the one who can guide us and direct us and show us the way it ought to be. In Exodus chapter 6, you have this declaration where God says to Moses, God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. This is the El Shaddai. But by my name, Yahweh, I did not make myself known to them. This is one of those big mystery passages. A lot of people argue that this means that Yahweh should not appear in the book of Genesis at all. That the revelation of Yahweh as the name of God appears actually in Exodus chapter 3. When Moses asks what is his name, and God says, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. And then Moses will be told, by my name, Yahweh, I was not known previously. Were they oblivious to the name of Yahweh in the book of Genesis? Well, many will argue, a lot of people, believers and skeptics alike, will often argue, well, Yahweh was not the name that was known at all in the book of Genesis, and all those places where the term Yahweh appears are sort of editorial modifications to clarify who the God is under consideration. I understand that. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. Okay. The Bible says in Genesis chapter 4, verse 26, that in the days of Seth and Enosh, they began to call upon the name of Yahweh, the name of the Lord. Now, that's way back there. Now, again, one approach, and I'm not suggesting that they don't believe the Bible necessarily, but one approach is that this is an editorial adaptation from roughly the time of Moses and perhaps even later to impose that on the narrative. Abraham, according to the text, addresses Yahweh as Yahweh in Genesis chapter 15. When he is talking to the Lord and objecting to, I don't have an heir yet. Eliezer, who's born in my household, is my heir. You know, and he'll address him as God, as Yahweh, God Elohim. Yahweh Elohim. Over 80 times in the book of Genesis, the term Yahweh appears. Now, I'm unembarrassedly conservative. I hope I'm a thinking conservative. Okay. But when it comes to the Bible, I look at it conservatively. I'll concede that point. And to a lot of folks, I immediately, well, you know what you're doing. Okay. But I think the issue of that they did not know me as Yahweh has to do probably with a relational, revelational knowledge. Not that they're oblivious to the name that applies. But God has not revealed himself in a special dynamic way. Now, admittedly, the birth of Isaac when Sarah is 90 years old was rather extraordinary, especially given the way the Bible describes it. But that's a fairly unique phenomenon within the context of the book of Genesis. But look at this passage here where God says this in Genesis chapter 6, beginning with verse 6. He says, say therefore, now I want you to listen carefully to this. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am Yahweh, your God, who has brought you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you for a possession. I am Yahweh. This is right on the heels of him saying, by my name Yahweh, I did not make myself known to them. Now, notice the structure of this. I am Yahweh, verse 6. I will bring you out, I will deliver you, I will redeem you, I will take you, I will be your God, I am Yahweh. I will bring you out, bring you into, I will give it, I am Yahweh. Given what's going on here, I'm inclined to think that this is a relational kind of thing. It's an extraordinary kind of event where God takes a people in a unique kind of way. Now listen to this admittedly somewhat long passage. For ask now of the days that are past, which were before you, since the day that God created man on the earth, and ask from one end of heaven to the other, whether such a great thing as this has ever happened or was ever heard of. Did any people ever hear the voice of a God speaking out of the midst of the fire, an allusion back to Exodus 19, as you have heard and still live? Or has any God ever attempted to go and take a nation for himself from the midst of another nation? By trials, by signs, by wonders, and by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great deeds of terror, all of which the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes. To you it was shown, that you might know that the Lord is God. There is no other besides him. I'm inclined to think this is the relational knowledge about which God is speaking in Exodus 6. Not, what's that name again? Now, again, I understand the other proposition, and I certainly don't want to leave the impression that someone who advocates that those are editorial additions are, you know, skeptics and unbelievers. But I think there's another meaningful way to look at this. This brings us to the end of this session. I'm going to stop now, give you a break, and give me a break. And we'll commence with our session in just a few minutes. Thank you.